like to say a few preliminary words, including reminding you please to turn off all cell phones and anything else that might go beep, twerp, whistle, tweet, etc. Thank you. We are pleased to be able to offer an ongoing series of diverse events with authors, scholars, and performers. For a list of our upcoming events, please pick up a copy of the September-October newsletter at the front desk. The late fall newsletter will be out very shortly. And I remind you that the Society Library thrives and prospers through the generosity of its donors. Tax-deductible contributions can be made at any time throughout the year. We particularly welcome underwriting for events like this one or for many of the library's other special projects. For more information, please speak to me or to our development staff or see our website. We have books, both hardcover and paperback, for sale in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery following the event, and our speakers will be happy to sign copies. It's now my pleasure to turn you over to our trustee, Jenny Lawrence, who will introduce our speakers.
Good evening and welcome. This is a talk about Jay Lachlan, founder and editor of the publishing company New Directions. Jay Lachlan, from 1914 to 1997, was born in Pittsburgh and the heir to a steel fortune. He attended Andover and then went on to Harvard. And at 19, he was in Paris helping Gertrude Stein organize her papers. In 1936, while still an undergraduate at Harvard, he founded New Directions Publishing, instigated and encouraged by Ezra Pound, and launched with an anthology of prose and poetry that was to become an annual anthology. And there were more than 50 of such anthologies. His financial resources enabled him to escape the strictures of commercial publishing, and he could find and publish writers who intrigued him. And over the years, New Directions writers have been Gertrude Stein, Ezra Pound, Delmore Schwartz, Kenneth Rexroth, William Carlos Williams, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Robert Creeley, Denise Levertov, Dylan Thomas, Garcia Lorca, Boris Pasternak, Christopher Isherwood, Vladimir Nabokov, and the list goes on and on. He rescued from out of print such authors as E.M. Forrester, Joseph Conrad, Evelyn Waugh, Henry James, Nathaniel West, James Joyce, D.H. Lawrence, the list goes on and on. Often the mementos of a life get buried and lost unless organized into a book. Yet here, the ephemera of an extraordinary life culled from Jay Lachlan's files and collected into The Way It Wasn't have been transformed into a marvelous compendium. We find random bits from literary scenes, fragments of letters, snapshots, tantalizing scraps with no dates or captions, yet organized, yes, alphabetically. Daniel Javitch co-edited this volume with Barbara Epler, formerly the editor-chief of New Directions. Daniel is a professor, is that right?
Presently.
Daniel is a professor of comparative literature at NYU, specializing in European literature of the Renaissance, poetic theory before 1700, and the evolution of ancient genres like epic and comedy, tragedy and romance, particularly in the 16th and 17th centuries. He is the author of two previous books, proclaiming a classic, The Canonization of Orlando Furioso, and Poetry and Courtliness in Renaissance England. Among his honors, he was a fellow of the American Academy in Rome from 1989 to 1990 and awarded a Guggenheim in 1995 and 6. Perhaps most relevant is that Daniel is Jay Lachlan's son-in-law, so he's had a long and unique relationship with Jay Lachlan, whether sharing an appreciation of fly fishing or wine or prose and poetry. Gus Powell is a freelance photographer, photo editor, and designer. His photographs have been exhibited at the Art Institute of Chicago, the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, and most recently, the Museum of the City of New York. His editorial work has appeared in publications like Fortune and Vogue, and he is a regular contributor to The New Yorker. He has collaborated with designer Rodrigo Corral on several projects for New Directions, including The Way It Wasn't. And most recently, he has become the son-in-law of Daniel, which would make him the grandson-in-law of Jay Lachlan. So this evening is a tribute to Jay Lachlan and New Directions. Please welcome Daniel Javitch and Gus Powell.
Thank you, Jenny, for a warm introduction. This is not going to be a public lecture, but an illustrated reading of selections from The Way It Wasn't, the autobiographical album or chapbook about James Lachlan that was edited by Barbara Epler, editor-in-chief at New Directions, and myself, and designed by Gus Powell and Rodrigo Corral. Gus, I should say right away, convinced Barbara and me that the book should be more amply and more lavishly illustrated than what we had originally planned. We heeded his good advice, and he was responsible for the inspired selection and layout of the photos, some of which you'll see tonight. Let me briefly explain the genesis of the book. Although Jay Lachlan, I'll call him Jay from now on, was asked by several publishers to write a regular prose autobiography, he declined and chose instead to undertake a long autobiographical poem and verse, segments of which he began to publish in 1993, 10 years after he began to gather and compose these recollections of his life. He called the project Byways, and it was far from finished when he died in 1997. But the segments that he had completed were collected and published by New Directions in 2005. Some of you may have seen this book. It's the scope of this verse narrative was ambitious. It weaved together family history, Jay's early memories of travel in Europe and America, his student years at Harvard, his first meetings in Rapallo with Ezra Pound, who instructed Lachlan, then 21 years old, to found New Directions, a publishing house so inventive and daring, in the words of Guy Davenport, that it brought modernist writing to us as assiduously and triumphantly as the Museum of Modern Art brought us 20th century painting and sculpture. The segments he finished of Byways also included accounts of the first decades of his publishing venture, reminiscences of his close friendship with ND authors such as William Carlos Williams, Thomas Merton, Kenneth Rexroth, his post-war work in India for the Ford Foundation, and his numerous early loves. When JL started gathering material for Byways, he devised a system of folders, alphabetically ordered, the labels usually indicating names of individuals and places that had figured significantly in his life. And into these folders, he would insert reminiscences, pertinent letters, photographs, newspaper clippings, plot outlines of what he would write about, brief scribbled notes, all of which were to serve as mnemonic aids that would help compose the segments he would eventually write in verse. We used to refer to these two large file boxes of autobiographical material as the Byways files. What you have to understand is that these files contained a great deal more than the segments of Byways that were published in the book. For example, there was a good deal more about the Lachlans, who, as many of you know, were wealthy Pittsburgh magnates who owned Jones and Lachlan Steel. There was miscellaneous documentation on Norfolk, Connecticut, and his life there. Several thick files on his 50-year-old involvement with Alta ski lifts in Utah, as well as his other skiing memories, and especially there were many more recollections of encounters with numerous other New Directions authors, as well as writers he didn't publish, and accounts concerning non-literary friends famous and less famous. Barbara Epler and I decided that as a supplement to Byways, we would put together an anthology of this autobiographical trove and present it alphabetically as it had been filed by Jay. Selective though we were, my tendency was to include more rather than less in the various entries, and it is thanks to Barbara's brilliant editing and judicious cutting that the book has turned out to be as zippy as it is. And as I already said, Gus persuaded us to add many more pictures, a number of which were culled from family albums and Jay's separate photo archive. I want to say one more thing in the way of an introduction. The title, The Way It Wasn't, was Jay's own suggestion, as one of the first entries in the book makes clear. The counter-truth claim of this title was ironically dismissive. Yet what struck Barbara and me when we studied the photographs often included in the folders was how many of them corroborated Jay's various recollections of his life. So one of our criteria of selection was to take accounts of his life that were in some ways unusual and seemed possibly made up, but that would be documented by photographs. The effect we sought was to render the title even more ironic. Let me give you two initial examples, and the subsequent slideshow accompanying my reading will offer a few more. The first example is an entry under Childhood with the subtitle All of a Sudden, Peggy. Let me read you the entry. I went to Arnold School, that would have been in Pittsburgh, not Shadyside, and there was a play called All of a Sudden, Peggy, in which I was the female lead. It was presented in an auditorium at Tech, that may be Carnegie Tech, which had a theater department run by a very elegant Englishman. He got angry with me because there was food in one scene, creamed chicken, which I gobbled hungrily, forgetting that I had lines to say. The second example is taken from a long entry on Elizabeth Bishop, the now celebrated poet, whom Jay got to know better in the early 1940s when he was visiting Key West, when he was in Key West visiting Tennessee Williams. Bishop was also there with her friend Louise Crane, and all of them spent time together. Jay describes at one point their visit of a local brothel, which was housed in an old wooden building that had a square roof. The place, he writes, and now I'm quoting him, was indeed known as the Square Roof, and the young ladies who worked there were of dusky complexion. The madam of the Square Roof was elderly. She must have been very pretty once. She had somewhat elegant manners. She enjoyed making polite conversation. I wanted to ask her if Hemingway had ever been a patron of the house when he lived in Key West, but decided I'd better not, a confidential matter. The young ladies were of various dimensions, including one who was quite rotund, a special taste. They were wearing their church dresses. Their guardian informed us that some were Methodists and some Baptists, and that they attended Sunday services regularly. The Laughlins, as I said, were Pittsburgh steel magnates who first built their fortune during the Civil War, selling rails, as Jay writes, for the Northern armies as they moved south. In the next generation, they sold pipe for the oil fields in Texas, and then structural steel for skyscrapers. Here is an entry on his great-grandfather under Ancestors. We're now on the letter A. Great-grandfather. He writes, "Of course, I never knew great-grandfather. He died in 1882, but I know him from the engraving in the big leather-bound volume, American Families of historic lineage. That's the picture. In the engraving, great-grandfather has a thin face, whiskers, and a sanctimonious Presbyterian look. He looks kind, but they say he was rough with the steel mill workers. But not as rough as great-uncle Henry Clay Frick, who had his works show what for by gunfire in the great Homestead strike. And moving from ancestors, here's an entry under Aunt Lila. This was Jay's aunt, Aunt Lila. Various of my uncles, he writes, were pretty crackers, and my dear aunt was, to put it mildly, difficult, wrong-headed about certain things. I've decided to put in the facts, but not make a big thing of it. None of them ruined my life in any way. To the contrary, in the case of my aunt, her generosity was what got new directions started, and her patience with my slew of girlfriends was remarkable. Given her background, she disapproved of many things I was doing, but she never lowered the boom on me. And then in another entry on his aunt, he writes, she had the ear of an angel with whom she communicated by automatic writing. She was on the telephone to Mrs. Sage, the medium over in Pleasantville, New York, every day. Curiously, the angel's name was not Lister, but Lester. Lister, by the way, was the name of her husband, Lister Carlyle. I was often the subject of those letters. She would write, "Dear Lester, I'm worried about James. He keeps making girls fall in love with him." And here, now, speaking of ancestors, is a moving entry about his father. This is an F. One day, when I was just past 14, my father suggested that we go down to Florida. "What's the point," I asked, "when grandfather's place has been sold to the missionaries for a boarding school?" "Trust me," he said, "you'll be surprised." So we took the train and got off at Daytona, which has a very big beach where the sand is so hard that cars can race on it. Was he going to go in for racing? Not at all. We took a taxi to the marina, which is not on the ocean, but on the inland waterway, which runs down the whole eastern coast of Florida. We walked out on the pier, and there amid the other boats that were tied up was a beautiful little cabin cruiser. My father walked up to it and told me to get aboard. "It's yours, mate, and it's named Sarsho, which means fish in Seminole language." I burst out crying at such a gift. It turned out that the Sarsho had been designed by my father. He showed me his sketches explaining various points. "But there's one thing you must promise me. This is light construction. You must never take it out into the ocean. Big waves might break it up." It wasn't a large boat, only about 30 feet from stem to stern, but it had everything just right to accommodate two people. And this, by the way, is another example of the corroboration that I'm talking about, provided by photographs. We're in the letter F. Here's an entry under Robert Fitzgerald. The poet Robert Fitzgerald was one of Jay's oldest friends. He already knew him when Jay was at the Choate School, and then they were both at Harvard together. Fitzgerald produced what, in my opinion, remains the finest modern English translation of Homer's Odyssey. Here's the entry. "On the wall of my dressing room, there is an enlarged photograph of two old geezers riding in a golf cart. The photographer has caught them in the middle of a conversation. What are they talking about? The fine golf shots and long putts they've made? No, they're talking about Homer. One of the golfers knows all there is to know about Homer. He is Robert Fitzgerald, the translator of the Iliad and the Odyssey. The other one is one of his publishers who has been struggling for over 50 years trying to learn Greek, but having spread his life in six directions, has never managed to accomplish it." And speaking of old friends, here's an entry under Brendan Gill. I should say that In the last decade of his life, Jay wrote a great deal of poetry. He was published widely, but in 1991, when the letter I will read from was written, he had still not appeared in the New Yorker. The letter is to Brendan, an old friend whom he saw more often on the Norfolk golf course than in New York. Dear Brendan, I've had a full life and I'm ready to go. Not a full as life as yours. I've never held hands with Jackie. That would be Jackie Onassis. But there is an unfulfilled longing. I want to be published in your great magazine. You remember that Brendan was a contributing editor to the New Yorker for over 50 years and one of the pillars of the magazine. I know you are irresistible to all the ladies in your office. Could you take Alice out to lunch at the Algonquin and tell her this is a great poem? There was a poem included, obviously, with the letter. Get a receipt and I'll gladly remit. Or if she doesn't want to be seen with you in public, bring her a tall red rose for her desk. Tell her it comes from an ancient poet who is dying of Cytherism, who wants to go down to Cerebus, famous, clutching a copy of the magazine. Please point out to her that I know Mr. Newhouse is rather conventional, so let's not embarrass him. I have not employed my usual taciturn metric, but I have typed it out as free verse with capitals and punctuation. Do this, dear Brendan, as a parting kindness to your old chum. If I have a remission and can stagger again onto the links, I'll drive 3 balls into the pond on number 7 so that you can win. I know how much winning means to you. One more from an entry about an old friend. This is under Jack Hines. Jack Hines was a childhood and lifelong friend of Jay's who eventually oversaw the Hines Company and its 57 varieties. They did a lot of skiing together, both here and abroad. When Jack and I first started skiing together, we remember the poverty of childhood. We grew up in great houses, but we never had any money. Money, no doubt, was corrupting for children. I had an allowance of 25 cents a week. Perhaps Jack had 50 cents. It took us a long time to get over that. Once, I remember, must have been 1945, we bought a Monte Cristo cigar in a restaurant. It probably cost a dollar. We declined a second. Jack took out a penknife and cut it in half. We each smoked half a cigar and felt virtuous. But there was a gradual relaxation of the Presbyterian ethic. It was Jack who taught me all I know about wines and good cooking. The high point was our visit for lunch to Monsieur Poin's restaurant near Lyon. There were 13 courses, beginning with pâté of nightingale. Between each course, the sommelier would approach with, quote, a nice little local wine you'll enjoy. Neither of us dared to drive the car. A taxi took us to the local inn to sleep it off. Once we were in Crespi's in Rome, and there was a great spinach soup that I liked. He went out to the kitchen and tipped the chef to give him the recipe. When he got home to Pittsburgh, he gave it to his chef at the plant and had him copy it. Then he had the plant turn out 1,000 cans and gave 100 batches to me and other friends. This is an entry under Irish and is another fine example of the sort, the photograph at least, of the sort that I mentioned at the start. Irish, it says. Because most of the Irish in Pittsburgh were workmen or servants, there was a fiction that we were Scots. My father ordered a complete Scottish outfit for me, kilt and sash, sporran and dirk, in which I enjoyed showing off on special occasions. To be sure, the Lachlans were Protestant, Irish from the Pale, which meant that they had originated in Scotland. Speaking of the Irish, here's a short entry under James Joyce. When Joyce opened the door for me in Paris, he said, "I think, Mr. Loguelin, we met for the last time on the battlefield of Clontarf." Then he explained that my name meant Danish pirate. Let me just note that the Battle of Clontarf occurred in 1014. A short entry under Henry Miller. Jay published virtually all of Henry Miller's numerous works except for The Tropic of Cancer and The Tropic of Capricorn. I wager that half the exploits in Henry Miller's Tropics books were imaginary. He was not Errol Flynn. He resembled the clerk in our rural general store and was equally loquacious. Under M2, there's an entry, one of several, on Thomas Merton. I love to go down to Gethsemane to visit him at the monastery because, very simply, we had such good times. I would pick up a car at the Louisville airport and drive down to the monastery. Pax intrantibus, peace to those who enter, it says over the gate. Father Abbott always gave Tom permission to go off with me for the day. Tom would start out circumspectly. He would go to the storage room for an old bishop's suit and exit from the monastery looking very ecclesiastical so as not to shock the gate brother. A few miles, and he'd say, "Stop here." He would go into the woods, take off his bishop's suit, put on his blue jeans, his old sweater, and his beret, and get back into the car with a sigh of relief. Then we would head east, stopping, I must confess, at a few rural beer parlors along the way. Tom was always very popular with the local farmers. He knew how to talk to all kinds of people. They found him funny, and they liked him. And then in another very short entry under Merton, it says, Tom could talk with any kind of person. He could have talked with an Eskimo. Under M, an entry under Marianne Moore. I used to take Miss Moore to the ball games. She knew everything there was to know about baseball, even more than. She had seen Bobby Thompson hit his famous tie-breaking homer at the Polo Grounds. But I could tie her on that. I had seen Mazeroski's famous homer over the scoreboard at Forbes Field when the Pirates beat the Yankees. Miss Moore was a living doll and the soul of kindness. But she did go on and on when she telephoned. N. Nabokov, under Nabokov. Again, Jay published most of Nabokov's fiction in the 1940s, but he decided not to publish Lolita. Here is an entry on the subject. What you don't understand is that at the time he wrote Lolita, this was a dirty book. I was very fond of him. He'd spent the summer with me in the Alta Lodge out hunting butterflies. His nice wife was there and the child, the innocent child. I wrote saying, "Volia, you are so sophisticated, you may not realize the effect that this book is going to have on the college community of Cornell if you publish it. Your wife will be ostracized. Stones will be thrown at your child." He said, "Well, maybe. What'll I do with it?" I suggested that he send it to Giraudier at the Obelisk Press in Paris, which is what Nabokov did. College communities are so awful, some of them, in that respect. No tolerance. Maybe they're better now. I don't know. I remember that I used to visit with L.R. Lind at the University of Kansas. Before we could have a drink, he had to pull down the shades in the room. This was my slant on the college communities. And I'm going to take a little pause now so that Gus can show show you a few of his favorite entries and say something about them before I resume.
Thank you, Daniel, and thank you to the library for having us here. I tried to pick a few entries that are more about visuals and more about discoveries of things that we found in the archives. And it was this book was so much fun and such a pleasure to work on. And when I saw the manuscript that Barbara and Daniel had put together early on, which had sort of cobbled things from byways and other things that they found in the files and other images that they knew existed, it immediately got me incredibly excited. Because I also, since I've know the family, I'd had opportunities to sort of dig into those files and see the actual things, and I already knew those baseball pictures of Marion Moore, and I just sort of couldn't wait to sort of see what else could be found. So one of the first ones I'm going to begin with is going backwards to B. This is an entry under Bergman. Now if you had Bergman's Three Strange Loves on your list, I could anecdotalize about that. This is an important film because it has my eye in it. Two lovers are arguing in the compartment of a train. Three or four times the camera flashes to a book one of them has been reading, which is lying on the seat. What does the camera see? It sees my eye, which is the artwork for the jacket of our edition of Henry Miller's The Cosmological Eye. This photo was created by two students in Dunster House, Harvard. They had the negative of the clouds. They made one of my eye and merged the two together. What did Bergman see in my eye? I wrote to him to ask, but he didn't answer. If you want to add Three Strange Loves to your list, you're welcome to this strange little story. Pound used to talk about le criticism indécrit, which he claimed Cocteau practiced. So again, this is one of these things where we hear the story, and then it turns out this is not that popular a Bergman film, so it was pretty difficult to dig it up. But we got the film, and sure enough, there's this 2 second shot of the book existing there. One of the heroes of the design world is Alvin Lustig, and specifically the work that he did for New Directions. And he's been getting more and more known recently, but it's something where you have designers who will fight one another to get a hold of old copies of Lustig jackets. And anybody in the design community knows about New Directions, if not because of the words that were printed, but certainly because of the jackets and the design history. And this was definitely something that I was excited about in terms of participating with the project, and also Rodrigo Corral, who's not here tonight, because we really knew those jackets, and to get to sort of participate in that history was something that was very exciting. So I'm just going to read the entry that we have on Lustig. And also just on a note, to all of the letters you see, which are in the book as full pages, these were colors that we took from old Lustig book jackets. I well remember my first contact with the work of Alvin Lustig. It must have been in 1939. He would have been around 24. I was in Los Angeles, or rather in one of those sugar candy suburbs that line the boulevards running towards the sea. A writer friend had told me that I ought to investigate a young chap who was doing queer things with type. And so I tracked him down to a workroom in the back of a drugstore. It took me only a few minutes to realize that I had made the acquaintance of a person, as the saying is. The slightly built young man, with his graceful and definitively masculine movements, with those magnetic and searching eyes, had the unshy quietness of speech and gesture, which is sometimes the outward mark of inner power. One of my favorite folders was found in the H section, which is a section called Hiram Handspring. And little bits of ephemera that pertain to Hiram Handspring are all over the place. And here's just the entry on, I'll give you a first image. Hiram Handspring. I'm not sure who my double really is. He began long ago when I started putting the name Hiram Handspring on comical parody pieces in the New Directions annuals. A clown, harmless fellow. But now I think he's become rather sinister. He keeps pushing me to write everything in a sort of black humor, a sardonic tone. My shrink's not much help. He doesn't believe in devils and just laughs. There's a whole body of correspondence that he had with Brendan Gill and many others where he would use this. But also, he had a small Xerox machine in his back office, and there were these folders of little bits of things that he had clipped. Some of you might recognize this image. Beneath it, it says, handspring at the age of 18, when he matriculated at Saskatoon University. You got it, exactly, yeah. But it's also handspring, apparently. This one says, this is what handspring's father told him life was all about. Which I just love as this sort of act of sort of self-publishing in the back office, taking four pieces of bacon and deciding to put it on the Xerox machine. And, you know. And then there happened to have been a fire, and Daniel kept referring to the back office and everything that existed there as the ashes. And the handspring file was one section that actually was singed a little bit crisped in a fire. This is what handspring decided for himself that life was all about. And this is, again, another example of these. It says, what does it say? It's something like, there were a number of these examples of redo from gum bands. I mean, they kept finding these other things that he was going to do something with and that was somehow going to fit into the life and history of handspring. So I'm going to go back to Daniel now.
Here's an entry under parties. I don't do very well at cocktail parties, but I went to this one in New York in 1942 because it was given by Lincoln Kirstein, who has been one of my great culture heroes since 1933 when he began publishing Hound and Horn. Lincoln gives fine parties, but my luck held poor. Lionel Trilling, whom I had persuaded to write his brilliant book about E.M. Forster, thought I was George L.K. Morris, the abstract painter. Lincoln introduced me to Roger Stevens, the fourth time I'd met him, and the great father of the theater blessed me with the same stare of complete non-recognition. Then, in the gallery room, by himself, and as if trying to fade into the wall, I saw a not large, youngish blonde man in a rumpled gray sweater who seemed to be having as hard a time as I was. It was Tennessee Williams. We got to talking and discovered that we were both great fans of the poets Hart, Crane, and Rilke. Tennessee told me that he never traveled anywhere without the poems of Crane in his knapsack. Those were the days before fame and airplanes for him, when he did most of his trips by hitchhiking. There are a number of entries, as you might imagine, on Ezra Pound. Here is one that recalls when Pound was incarcerated at St. Elizabeth's Hospital after nearly being tried for treason right after the war. He was confined to the hospital for 13 years. I remember the fuss we were in when Ezra was brought to Washington and we didn't know what to do about it. Both Eliot, that would be T.S. Eliot, both Eliot and Dorothy, his wife, were in favor of the insanity approach, so we went for that. It was a long stay that he had at the government's expense. I would get down to see him now and then, and he always seemed remarkably cheerful. After all, they took good care of him, feeding him well, and letting Dorothy come in for lunches. He was allowed guests as long as they weren't journalists. He didn't have to worry about much, except for the destruction of the world. There are a number of entries that discuss other poets, and will be sometimes under other poets, that bring up Ezra Pound. Here's one under Robert Duncan. Robert Duncan reported this nice little Ezra story. My name came up at St. Liz, that would be St. Elizabeth, and Ez declared, jazz has a very long spine, and he is always breaking it skiing, so when I kick his butt about what he should publish, the message does not ascend to his brain. Letter R. This is an entry under Kenneth Rexroth, who was one of Jay's important literary advisors, as well as a prolific and the author. He put Jay onto Denise Levertov, Gary Snyder, and a number of other West Coast poets. Jay spent quite a bit of time with Rexroth in San Francisco in the 1940s, and they also liked to go into the mountains together. Here is an entry about such an outing. The clarity of the stars seen through tent flaps. Rexroth and I often went camping in the Sierras. As we walked along, he would explain all the flora and the geology. He was the best camp cook I ever knew. He could make delicious meals out of things that were light to pack. The master of tomato paste. He always took short pack rods. He could see a trout under the water 30 feet away. He knew the names of all the stars and the myths that went with them. One of our best trips was in late spring, but there was still plenty of snow. We climbed in on skis from Bishop on the eastern slope. We camped near a frozen lake. He dug a berth in a snowbank with a ski end and bedded it with fir boughs. He really didn't care much about skiing. He just liked to be in the mountains. Next day, I climbed up a big ridge, but he sat all day on a stump, meditating. I looked back down at him every now and then, and he never changed his position for 3 hours. And here's another entry under Rexroth. Kenneth sure had a messed up life. I wonder he accomplished so much as he did. Once he took me to a fancy lunch with some of his rich Jewish friends on Pacific Heights. The hostess asked me, "Don't you think Kenneth burns with too bright a flame?" Sure enough. S. Under Siddhartha. The longer I publish, the less I know what it's about or what makes a book sell. Sometimes the books I think are the best don't sell at all, whereas others that I don't think are so good sell very well. A case in point is Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, which Henry Miller sent my way. Henry was quite a mystic, and he loved philosophy. He always said he wanted to die in Tibet. Henry was a dear man, but he never made it to Tibet because his Japanese friend spent so much of his money. Now I'm sure he is in some happy place where people as nice as Henry go, though some of his favorite sports may not be available to him in the form which he has now assumed. Anyway, Henry kept writing me about the Hesse book. An English lady, Hilda Rosner, had sent him a translation of Siddhartha. I went through it and thought it was very readable, but a little too Germanic, and the message just Buddhism with sugar coating. I stalled, but Henry would write about every 3 months saying I had to publish that book. Finally, to oblige Henry, I did. The first year, it sold about 400 copies. But sales kept growing, and at the height of the Hesse boom, we sold 250,000 copies in a year. And since we're on the subject of publishing, here's an entry under Saroyan, William Saroyan. This is in a letter of 1937 to William Saroyan. So imagine JL is 23. I'm sorry, but I can't let you have proofs on the stories. By sad experience, I've had to make that the rule. If I let every contributor have proofs, it would cost me $150 in corrections. You don't know what authors are like because you are one. First, authors don't know that corrections cost $3.50 an hour. Secondly, they don't realize that when they change one word in linotype, it knocks out a whole page of slugs, and that costs 2 or 3 hours' time to fix. Thirdly, authors just have to take one look at a page of proofs to go entirely crazy and decide they are Jesus instead of Napoleon and rewrite the damn thing. I'm sorry, I just can't afford it. you authors will have to realize that we small publishers can print you, but can't humor you. And under S, Delmore Schwartz, this passage that I will read was prompted by the publication of the correspondence between Jay and the poet Delmore Schwartz, who actually assisted J.L. in the early days of New Directions. "Wasn't Delmore wonderful? This shows where some of my funny tone comes from." He's referring to the letters. "Though also Perlman and Dudley Fitz, but Delmore was six times better. Reading his letters makes me guffaw and weep. The end of his life was so ghastly. Going through the book, you can watch him fall apart." Saul Bellow was writing about Delmore Schwartz in Humboldt's Gift. "It's a very accurate portrait. Delmore was always inventing fantastic schemes. Hutchins is called Long Seth." Hutchins would be Robert Hutchins. "And I was called my Playboy publisher. That came out of the fact that once Delmore sent a manuscript to me at Alta, which got lost in the bottom of the mailman's truck coming up the canyon. It was some time before the manuscript was recovered. Delmore was very agitated. He said that I would have to decide whether I was going to be a playboy or a publisher." And under S, one of the entries under skiing, they would have been, had he ever progressed more with Byways, very large segment on skiing, which was one of Jay's great passions. Got a subtitle, "The Adventures in St. Anton," or of St. Anton. If I recall correctly, Jay was skiing in Austria at a young age in the mid-1930s, and skiing then was a little different than it is now. "That was where I had my pants sewn up by the Queen of Holland. A group of us out on a tour, I fell and put a big rip in the butt of my hosen. But Her Majesty had a sewing kit in her zits pack and quickly repaired me. Then there was the promising young conductor from Vienna, Herbert von Karajan, a fine and fearless skier. He took pity on my shortage of cash for the buses. He would ride me up the mountain in his chauffeured car, then let me ski down with him, coached by his private instructor, Lugi Forger." And here under S, we come to Gertrude Stein. As Jenny mentioned, Jay spent several weeks with Gertrude Stein in the summer of 1934. He was actually already 20, I think, by then, at her house, Biligna. And this is a segment from a long letter to his parents dated July 9, 1934. "Dear Mother and Father, I have been here now 4 days in this beautiful place with Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas and Bernard Fay and Basket and Peppy, who are dogs, and I am very content indeed. Since I have been here, I have done most and best the changing of tires. Every day when we go riding, a tire goes flat, and sometimes twice, and then I change them. Miss Stein is very glad to have me along to change them, because usually she just waits until someone comes along on a bicycle and does it for her. After lunch, we go driving in the Ford. Miss Stein fills the car quite completely, though she is not big, but she is like a rock sitting there quite solidly. She drives very fast and very well and never looks at the road, but is never in the wrong place. Some days we go to see a church. One day we went to see a Roman column. Today we went swimming in the Lac de Bourget, and yesterday we went to X." And there is the Roman column that Jay is standing on with, holding Pepe. Okay, Ian will know. Pepe, that is the one. I don't know if he's. You see him in the photograph, jumping up on Gertrude. T. Dylan Thomas. This is about the death of Dylan Thomas. What his death certificate reads is insult to the brain. Someone had to go over to the morgue to identify the body because Dylan was a foreign citizen who had died under unusual circumstances. So John Brennan, the promoter of his American tours, and I tossed a coin. I lost, so I went. The morgue was part of Bellevue Hospital, not the beautiful new place that there is now where they put the bodies and you go in and there's lovely Muzak. Back then, it was an awful place, smelling of formaldehyde. There was this little old guy trundling corpses around on gurneys. He would pull a rubber sheet back and ask, "Is this him?" "No." "Is this him?" "No." Finally, we found him. He looked awful, all puffy and purple. "Yeah, that's him." And he said, "Well, you go over there to the window and identify him." In the window was a little girl. She was about 4 feet high, and I don't think she had even finished high school yet. She filled out the forms. She couldn't spell Dylan, so I spelled it out for her. What was his profession? He was a poet. That puzzled her. This little girl said, "What's a poet?" "He wrote poetry." So that is what the form says. Dylan Thomas, he wrote poetry. There are a number of entries, two on William Carlos Williams, but I've spared you those. And in Byways, if some of you get it, you'll see there's a wonderful segment on William Carlos Williams. But this is under Tennessee Williams. And what I'm going to read from first is a tribute that Tennessee prepared for delivery at the National Arts Club. This would have been in February 1983 when Jay was presented with a medal for literature. It was James Laughlin in the beginning, and it remains James Laughlin now, with never a disruption or moment of misunderstanding in a friendship and professional relationship that has now lasted for 40 years or more. By nature, I was meant more for the quieter and purer world of poetry than for the theater into which necessity drew me. And now at a time for reckoning, as a time for reckoning seems near, I know that it is the poetry that distinguishes the writing when it is distinguished, that of the plays and of the stories. Yes, that is what I had primarily to offer you. I am in no position to assess the value of this offering, but I do trust that James Laughlin is able to view it without regret. If he can, I cannot imagine a more rewarding accolade. What I didn't explain was that Tennessee Williams died the night before the ceremony took place under bizarre circumstances. When J.L. found out on the day he was to get the prize, he spent it composing the following poem with which I will close. It's entitled Tennessee. Tennessee called death the sudden subway, and now he has taken that train. But there are so many good things to remember. First, the young man in sloppy pants and a torn sweater whom I met at Lincoln Kirstein's party, we'll recall it. He was very shy and had hidden himself in a side room. I too was shy, but we got talking. He told me that he wrote plays and that he loved Hart Crane. He carried the poems of Crane in his knapsack wherever he hitchhiked. Then, his first night of glory in Chicago, when he and Laurette Taylor made a new American theater. I remember happy days with him in London and Italy and Key West, and how often friends and writers who were down on their luck told me how generously he had helped them. But you would never hear that from him. So many fine things to remember that I can live again in my mind until it is my turn to join him on the sudden subway. Thank you.